It was quite an odd thing because I saw Farage coming in. I'd never met him. And I saw him walking in. And the way they have you on the sofa, when it's Mar and then the two of you, it's a really tight shot because it's one camera. I don't know what made me do this, Cassandra, but I just patted the sofa next to me and said to Nigel, come on, come closer. I don't know what made me say that, but his face, he didn't know where to put himself. And it made him, I straight away saw him become incredibly nervous. And I don't know what it is that made me do that, but I was really terrified. And then some calm came over me as if to say, you can do this. It was just a weird sort of mix of emotions.
Welcome back to the Power Done Differently podcast. I'm Cassandra Ray. And if, like me, you've grown a little disappointed and disillusioned with the people in power, you're in the right place. In this podcast, you'll meet powerful, passionate women from around the world who are doing power differently. My guest today is Gina Miller. Now, you probably know Gina as the prominent anti-Brexit campaigner who successfully challenged the government in court and who became something of a favorite punching bag for extreme Brexiteers, both online and off. But if that's all you know about her, keep listening. There is so much more. Well before her Brexit-related notoriety, she was described by Bloomberg as a, quote, establishment wrecking ball. She's a serial entrepreneur, passionate philanthropist, and advocate for responsible capitalism who has campaigned in the areas of investment and pension reform, political transparency, modern-day slavery, and social justice, just to name a few. Gina also has just an incredible life story. She has straddled a life of poverty and affluence at different times, and she's a survivor of domestic violence. In their review of her book, Rise, the Sunday Times called Gina, quote, a woman of true grit and courage, of whom we should all, whatever our views on Brexit, be proud. Please enjoy this incredible conversation with one of the most intrepid and inspirational leaders of a generation, Gina Miller. Gina, welcome. Thank you for being here.
My absolute pleasure.
So I cannot do anything but start with the US elections today, because we are recording this on January 20th. In a few short hours, Biden will be sworn in, and so will Kamala Harris, our first woman of color in the White House. Obviously, you are well known in political circles in the UK, but I wanted to ask you what your feelings and thoughts were about this historic election.
Gosh, there's so much to say about this. I'm hoping that the last 4 years can be forgotten almost, or the damage that's done can be diminished as quickly as possible. I know that the Biden-Harris regime are hitting the ground running and want to be seen as a very proactive, inclusive regime to try and reverse some of the divisions and damage that's been done, not just to the democracy in the US, but actually to people's lives and the security of the nation, both in terms of its capital agenda, but also of its social agenda and its racist agenda and the things that have come to the fore. So I'm very hopeful, but I think it's sad that the win wasn't bigger, if you like, because there are going to be some challenges, not just in the legislature, but actually in the electorate as well. And I'm hoping, with a big spoonful of hope, that Donald Trump is actually leaving the scene. Some very bizarre scenes as he went into his helicopter and the speech on the stage. And you could see his reluctancy to wanting to leave the political stage.
Yeah, we shall see. I mean, no signs that he will accept reality and actually say that he lost the election, but it still feels like such a relief to be turning a page, at least in this moment in time. And I've been thinking a lot about the fact that it feels like it was this same kind of moment in time and moment in our, I don't know what the word is, it's almost like our political communities across lots of different countries, but certainly the US and the UK, that brought us Brexit in the UK and elected us Trump in the US. And, you know, I'm American, I live in London. Like, looking at these two things, it's so nice that we were able to turn a page. There's like this definitive point 4 years later that we could say, okay, we elected Trump. That was a mistake. We're now undoing that mistake. And with Brexit, we're not going to be given that same opportunity for at least a generation.
Well, I think there's a couple of things there where I think it gives the US the opportunity to take a different path. But it does send a very strong signal to the rest of the strongmen across the globe. And yes. I think what is very hopeful for us as, if you like, progressive people who believe in compassion and believe in democracy and believe in humanity is that, you know, strong men will not get away with it. And I think that is what is very hopeful, that the sign of Trump walking away is that we can redress the extremes that are happening across the globe in many different countries. And that is what I think the big message about this change is, that we can come back to making our societies much more tolerant and move forwards rather than undoing all the progress we made for decades in terms of our countries and our visions of the future and the environment and young people and how we live together. All of the things that were damaged by him, I think, in the US are also being damaged in other countries.
What do you think we can do over the next, say, I don't know, 6 months, 12 months, 24 months, to start to get us in a better place than we have been over these many years?
I think in the UK, those people who think the Brexit are over have already realized that it isn't. The deal that we've ended up with is sometimes called a thin deal, a hard Brexit, whatever the term is. When you look at the detail, because it's the detail that matters, there are huge gaping holes in it. There is so much uncertainty, and legislatively, there is a lot of legal uncertainty. There are lots of red flags and points of dispute that could rise in the future. So rather than thinking that this is over, this is going to be a negotiated process in many areas for many years to come. And not only is that such a terrible waste of our resources and the time, you know, we're going to have to set up, for example, 30 committees to replace those we left in the EU. So the waste of resources is shameful, I think, for the little that we will gain at this point in time. Actually, the majority of sectors are seeing losses. And the other thing that I think is extremely worrying is it's becoming very clear that whilst the drumbeat was for newfound freedoms, the politicians had not really put much thought into what it is we do with those freedoms. And that is where I really am concerned for us as a country, because whilst we are all Brexiteers now, if you like, we all have to live with the consequences, we won't be able to undo them anytime soon. Yes, there is a review clause in the deal for 5 years' time, but that's 5 years. So in the meantime, I think what we do is, first of all, we have to deal with COVID. Brexit will have to take a bit of a backseat for the next 6 months or so. Let's hope that the vaccine rollout carries on being a success and we are in a place where we can get back to some sort of normality. And then the true effects of Brexit will start affecting our everyday lives. And at that point, we have to hold the government to account, sector by sector, and say, well, you are going to have to go back and renegotiate something that benefits us as a country, or come up with some alternative plan. We are going to have to push the politicians to come up with the detail, because there is none at the moment. And we cannot carry on as a country just living in limbo and expecting others to solve our problems. We are going to have to be the proactive ones. And I think it's going to take an awful lot of time, energy, and ingenuity for us to both work together with the other side, because, as I say, we're going to have to put how we voted behind us, but try and come up with solutions across all our sectors, which means that we can limit the damage for the meantime until we have a political opportunity to try and reverse the damage of Brexit.
So it feels to me like this is where the rubber is going to meet the road. And I hear what you're saying about we're going to need to find these solutions, but are these solutions actually plausible? Do they exist in a world where the government we have wants to be as far away as they can be from our closest trading partners, and our further trading partners don't seem to be chomping at the bit to do deals with us?
They will, because the electorate will hold them to account. You're already seeing on a daily basis fishermen demonstrating with their trucks outside Parliament. When they feel it in their pocket and when they see the damage to their lives, they will speak up. And that is when politicians are going to have to either come clean on what it is their plans are, or they're going to have to go back to the drawing board and renegotiate. Because whatever happens, we are not geographically going to move our country away. Europe, as you quite rightly say, is still our closest partner. But if you think about it slightly differently, what is it that we want to change? Because from a future point of view, future lens, we more or less want the same things. And, you know, this government may try to move us ideologically away from what the world is converging on in terms of climate and foreign policy and how we tackle social media platforms and technology. But they're going to find it a very lonely place because there's a huge amount of alignment and convergence on the world stage. And we cannot survive as an isolated island. And they will find that out very quickly.
Mm. I have heard you say before that you could see that the kind of facts and figures approach that the Remain campaign was taking, you know, prior to the referendum wasn't working. And I think we've all seen afterwards that the Leave campaign, I'm trying to choose my words carefully here because I don't want to accuse people of something that isn't true. But on the other hand, I think it's important to see something and name it. They harnessed an undercurrent of racism and xenophobia as part of their campaign. And I'm wondering what that's going to do, if anything, to that undercurrent, right? Because it seemed like what it did after the referendum, in a very similar way to what happened when Trump was elected, is that came from behind the shadows much more to, oh my God, all of a sudden people feel like it's acceptable to say these things out in the open. And I'm wondering if we have hope for some of that starting to heal, or if it's just going to go back in the shadows and wait to be revived again.
I think you have to look at the facts and look at what happened in that period, because in all societies, at all periods of time in history, there are extreme elements in society. And what we do as a society, as a modern civilized society, we shun those voices and they exist on the fringes. Part of what happened is that we were pretty naive. Those who have enjoyed, if you like, the fruits of trickle-down economics and being a liberal society, we sort of became slightly naive to those voices still being there. Because what they did was they started picking at groups. They were very targeted. And when I remember going around the country and talking to people and saying, look, there are social media campaigns being operated, there are people who are being targeted. It's like there's parts of society who are hurting and who have scars, and there are those who are going picking at those scars and those hurts and making them into a reason for their suffering. Because at the end of the day, however you voted, everyone wanted a better life, a better future for themselves and their families. Only somebody who's clinically insane would actually vote to hurt themselves and their families. So if you start from the premise that people wanted lives to be better, they wanted their country to be better, what you then get to is, what were they being told that were the ways of achieving that? And going around saying that it was the EU's fault, that it was immigrants' faults, that it was because this person was taking your job, or whatever the reason, these things were or have been there for years. But something happened, especially with the use of social media, where they had a mechanism for, if you like, multiplying those voices who were preaching the lies and the racism and the misogyny. And they were able to not just amplify their voices, but they were able to target them in the most sophisticated ways, so that people thought that their news feeds were saying this. Every time they searched on social media, they were saying this. So they believed that it wasn't just a small number of people who agreed with them. They thought that everyone agreed with them. And that is what happened. There was a manipulation of messaging, and there was a manipulation of targeting in a way that we have never seen before, which is why one of the things we have to tackle before we can reclaim our society is going to have to be the way social media companies work, because they are coding for chaos. And that was shown in America. It was shown here with Brexit. It was shown in Catalonia and Spain. There are multiple examples across the globe of how that platform has poisoned our democracy and the way people think.
I completely agree with that. And I also feel like there is this way that educated liberals like me want to communicate, which is with, and this is going to sound so condescending, I don't mean it to be that way, but which is like with facts, right? What I feel like in these populist movements that we've seen around the world, what they communicate with instead is with emotion. It's a negative emotion, and yet it's emotion. And I had Anna Subri on the podcast a few weeks ago, and we talked about this. I remember I had attended a seminar when I was in business school with somebody from Saatchi & Saatchi. It's pretty much the only thing I remember from business school all these years later. And he just gave this seminar where he kept showing example after example of advertising campaign and just drumming home this point that reason leads to conclusion, emotion leads to action. Reason leads to conclusion, emotion leads to action. And that's something that's really stuck with me. And so as we're working to solve some of the undercurrents, the root of the problem of populism, I'm wondering how we can do a better job of harnessing positive emotions instead of just appealing to reason. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, because one of the things I was critical of is when with the sort of official Remain campaign is I kept saying to them that you have to think of the other side of better at marketing, and the three word slogan, all of these things are actually year one basic marketing tools. But the other side had started using them in a political manner. And, you know, I kept saying, let's hire the people who design washing machine adverts and, you know, washing powder and Coca-Cola. And they were saying, no, we know what to do. We are the political strategists. And so there is an egotism amongst the, what you call professional politicians as well and their advisors in that they think they know how people tick. And they have to understand that the other side didn't do that. They came together and used marketing tools and media, and they understood how to storytell. And we have to get better at doing that too, because, you know, you've got 3 seconds. It's a whole 3 second rule, 3 minutes. All the tools are there, but they haven't been used in the political arena to this extent. And they have been in recent years. But also remember that the populist playbook of denigrating experts, elites, liberals, the judiciary, the rule of law, harnessing the media to push out propaganda. This has happened throughout history. But again, I come back to the fact, but what they had now was technology and platforms to really increase in a way we've never seen before, the delivery of that populist playbook. And we were slow, I think, on our side to react to that. And unless we become realists, I think, and almost walk in the other side's shoes, I think we'll always be 2 steps behind.
How do we get to a place where we can accept the reality of what is and also get to a place where we are communicating our message in a more effective way?
We have to start with being humble and not, I told you so, as we go through this, because we cannot say the people, it is a minority who voted because they hate immigrants and they hate people with money and they hate, you know, all the hatred that's pumped out there. Because if you look at the facts, immigration prior to the referendum was not something a poll showed people were concerned about. It was about number 5 in their concerns. It was made to be a concern. It wasn't a natural concern. So what you have to do is get back to people and talking. We have to change our language. We have to start talking about the things that make us the same and what it is, and reach out and talk about our families, talk about our children, talk about the fact that we have members of our family who are suffering from disease and illnesses and are not being looked after. The fact that we have families in our communities who don't have access to the bare necessities, heating, food, clothes. And we have to go out there and find them and talk to people. Because if we just say, oh, we were right all along, this is how we knew this was going to happen, then we change nothing. And we are just as bad. And I think we have got to go the mile further. I've made the choice that I would go out to leave areas, and I deliberately go to areas where people scream and shout at me. And I'll say to them, I'm here to talk to you and with you. I'm not going anywhere, so you could either get hoarse shouting at me or we can start talking and listening to each other. And sometimes it's taken 5 minutes, sometimes it's taken 20. It's incredible how quickly you can change somebody because you took the time. We don't have to be exactly aligned, but we can be moving in the right direction, which is the same direction.
I've read your book, and so much has been really inaccurately portrayed. What is it that Andrew Neil said? What was that really insulting thing? Like, he said something like making Brexit the plaything of a rich woman.
Yeah,
or something.
I know. I kicked myself because what I really wanted to say, but I didn't have at that time. I was quite new at being on that sort of platform. And I didn't, because what I really wanted to say to him was, if you mean by passion that I spend all my spare time and energy doing this, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't want to like waste time talking about him, but I thought there was a really beautiful story. I think it was fairly early on in the book, maybe in chapters one or two, where you told a story about befriending your bully with a bracelet. I was wondering if you could retell that here.
I don't know what it is. I think I just nature, nurture. I was just born this way. When people bully me, I sort of watch them and listen to them rather than saying anything. And I then start this thought process of, so why are you bullying me? What is happening? Why are you hurting? What is it? And I was sent to boarding school when I was young because my life was in danger because my father was a politician trying to put our country back together and heal the division. So strange how things go and how lives go in circles. But I was sent over when I was 11 and my brother was 13 and I'd never left home ever. So there I was, 11 years old, in an English boarding school, not knowing the culture, not having ever left home, really feeling distraught that I had left my parents and my beautiful family in my home. And there I start getting bullied because I sound different. I looked different. I was different. And the one girl who was bullying me, she was incredibly crafty at how she did it, and the staff didn't know. But I thought, I wonder if I could turn you, flip you, and make you my friend, because there must be something in you that is yearning for friendship. So I gave her a present. My mother had given me one of her little gold bracelets to sort of wear when I was missing her. And I thought to myself, I'll put it in its pouch and I'll give it to her. And just said to her, you know, this is so that we could be friends. And she didn't say anything for a while. And I think a little bit later, she then started defending me against some of the other bullies. Years later, I actually got a letter from her saying that that bracelet is something she still prizes. And that the reason why she bullied is that her parents were diplomats and never came to see her. And she was just jealous of the fact that I had my little album with photos of my family. And I had this, you know, so much love for my family. So she was jealous. So she wasn't being a bully because she hated me. It was born out of jealousy and from her own yearning of wanting to be loved and cared.
What do you think at such a young age gave you that maturity that most people lack even in their adulthood and that ability to see things from that perspective, that empathy, I guess?
I don't ever remember being any different. I mean, I just think it's a nature nurture. I think I was just born that way. And it's quite interesting because of my three children, my son, my middle child has the same, he was born with it. When, you know, he was just a little boy, I could see it in him. And he is a peacemaker. He is a gentle man. And he will be a great healer when he grows up, because I can see it in him already that he has the ability to empathize with anyone.
There is an American author, you may or may not know her, but if the name rings a bell, let me know. Her name is Elizabeth Lesser.
Yes.
Yes. So I just recently read her book, not just because it has my name in the title, but it's called Cassandra Speaks. When Women Are the Storytellers, the Human Story Changes. It's an incredible book. I really recommend it. And one of the points that she makes in the book is that we have been told, and I mean, I thought this too, that when you are faced with a danger of any kind, emotional, physical, there's one of two responses that you will have. It's to either fight or to flee. Mm-hmm. And she makes the point that actually in nature, what we see is actually there's a third option, which is to connect. And that feels like the thing you're trying to do. Like in that story with the bracelet, but also that short piece where you met your troll. And it really felt like that was what you're doing. You weren't standing still and making yourself quiet and invisible. You weren't running away. You were saying, let me connect with this person in front of me. And that's what's going to remove the danger.
It is the old thing of if you can change the world one heart at a time and one mind at a time. And I've always believed that. And I think because who better, as you say, the troll that I met there, Alan is his name. And now he goes out and he doesn't have to say my name, but the thoughts I implanted hopefully in his mind, but also the compassion I encouraged him to feel for others and for me is something that he can now go and spread and pass that on to his son and his friends and his family. So he becomes the ripple for me doing that one thing. And I think that's where we have such incredible power. It's something I know women are really great at doing. we have the ability to send out a ripple of kindness and of conscience that can really change the way we look at society and interaction and the way the world works. But the problem is that we've been discouraged from doing that for generations, rather than explaining that actually they are infinitely the most powerful things you can have, and the ability to change someone's hearts and minds. You know, soft power is a real power, and that's what we have, but that's not how we've been socialized to think. And I would like to do that, building back better in the future, is for us to really rediscover that strength is not about rigidity, it's not about who's loudest, it's not about who's richest, it's not about who is the tallest, it's about who is the kindest, the most caring, the most inclusive. All of these things are huge changes, I know, but I think we have to start not just talking about them, because we have actually been talking about them for quite a long time. Now this is completely new. You know, we've been, the rhetoric around some of this has been there for, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, but it's time to actually put it into action.
I'm not naive to think that coronavirus and this moment that we're experiencing is necessarily going to lead to a much better place. And yet I think it does present an opportunity for us to rethink how we're structuring our economies, to rethink how capitalism can serve us and our communities better. What are your thoughts on where we can go from here to more drastically change the way things work to serve everybody?
I think we have to be very cautious and very alert, because there's a fork in the road. And I think whilst people talk about reform, it can go left or right. And some people will see it as an opportunity to bring in what I call survivalist economy, where what you do is actually you squeeze the middle class, you squeeze the people in the middle, and you actually ensure that there is an inflated 0.5% or whatever it is, those who command the control of money, power, technology, influence. There are those who believe that it is an opportunity to take away workers' rights, to health and safety at work. The women in the workplace was not a good thing. Why do you have to actually encourage people to have flexible working? But then on the other side, there are those of us who believe that with investment of time, energy, and collaboration, because it's going to take a lot of both of those things, there is a possibility to bring in change, which sees, for me, for example, a complete reforming of capitalism to responsible capitalism. It's not just about the aggressive pursuit of profit, but it is about that triple bottom line. It is about us being thinking about people, profit, planet, ESG, whatever you want to think it, call it, because it has many different names. But it's an opportunity to see capitalism where we have equal weighting to the social capital as well as a monetary capital. And I started talking about this in 1996. And at the time, most people sort of laughed and sort of said it was, you know, it was mama and papa type talking and it was utopian. Well, I don't think it is anymore. And I think what has happened is that coronavirus has allowed us to see each other in a different light and to recalibrate how we value people in our society and how we look at brands and how they operate, how businesses contribute their social capital. So I think we have to grasp that opportunity and build on it, being also very mindful that there are those who will see it in a completely 360 degree lens, which is it's an opportunity for them to grab more rather than give more.
I feel like I'm constantly fighting a little bit of a battle on two fronts with principled business. And what I have found is when that's married with politics, the repeated message was, unless you are a socialist, you are a horrible human being. And so to try to have this message to say, you can be a capitalist, you can believe that free markets are the way to rise everybody from poverty, but also not want it to be done in the way that it's being done in a lot of parts of the world, those two things can be concurrent. I never found a way to break through on that side.
What happens is when you go to the extremes, you go extreme right, extreme left, they actually then meet. And so,
yes, yeah, that's exactly what it feels like. Yeah.
And when you're in the middle and you're trying to be progressive, you get it from both sides. I can tell you, I have experienced that for 30 years. So I'm fully aware of it. But the issue is you have to somehow find a way of not listening. I don't listen to extreme voices because, to my view, they are the minority. We have to concentrate on where we can actually have an impact. And I think when it comes to politics, you're absolutely right, because you can't fix the capitalist structure without fixing the political structure, because they go together in a way. But we have to think about reforming our democracy in the UK, because one of the things we have, which is why it's so difficult for good people to go into politics, I know you'll hear this so often, especially for women, is we have the vitriol that they have to go back to social media. 19 of the women who stepped down before the December election, who did not run again, quoted the abuse they get, not just in social media, but actually from the more traditional media as being the main reason why they could not carry on and did not want to run again. Why should women have to leave the stage? We have to change the stage. And I think that the landscape of how we treat our politicians has got to change. But also, I think we have to have more checks and balances on our politicians. And normally when I say some of what I'm about to say to you, all sides all throw their hands up in sort of shock, because I think we have to have some sort of accountability from our politician. It amazes me that it is the only profession, supposedly profession, where there's no employment contract, even though we pay their wages, we as the public. Mm-hmm. There's no swearing in. There's no sort of, you know, the principles that they have to abide by and codes of conduct are not actually legally binding. I think we have to think about, do we start thinking about something that sits between the electorate and the politicians themselves, some sort of a deliberative democracy which sits on a regional basis where we have almost an inflated jury service type of structure where people can take turns, say, over a year to sit on panels to discuss different things. Do we say the politicians can't run for more than two terms? Do we say, as I said, we have some sort of an oath or some way of holding politicians to account if they're involved in dodgy dealings or found lying? We have to stop this thing about the fact that they can say what they want on the floor of the House and there's no recompense for any falsehoods that they say or misleading comments. We have to look at how do we rebuild democracy in a way and our political system in a way that people trust it and we attract people who are going to put the country before their own political party and their own political careers. We cannot carry on as we are. But of course, the present system serves too many. I know it's a tall ask, but I do think we have to think about it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it feels like there's this thread through your life that's more about using your voice and your influence and your power to stand up against abuses of power wherever you see them, including in politics and in finance. You know, this deep level of, I mean, to an American, like that you don't swear your MPs in is like weird to me. And that there's no written constitution, it's really hard to get my head around.
I don't know. The American forefathers must have seen Trump coming. I mean, it is quite extraordinary how robust the constitution is. And yes, it is quite, when I say to people, yes, we are only one of three countries that doesn't have a written constitution. And then I say, but also written constitutions haven't also ended tyranny, does not stop what's happening in, I know, Turkey or what's happening in Brazil, wherever it is that written constitutions are. There is room for some flexibility, but I think the prerogative powers need to be put into legislation and there needs to be some constitutional restraints and prerogative powers. It is extraordinary to me that that has not happened. And that's something I think has really seriously got to be debated when we come out of COVID.
Okay. All right. So we're going to switch gears here a little bit. We're going to finish up on what we call our Tilly round. This is a quick-ish fire round, so the questions can go fast or slow. What's one lesson you've learned the hard way?
Men you marry are not always what they seem.
You have a really revealing and heartbreaking, but also inspirational chapter in the book about overcoming having been a victim of domestic violence. And I thought that was so important because, and I think I heard you say this on an interview before as well, that we have this perception that it's only weak women that get themselves into abusive relationships, but actually men or women of all kinds of backgrounds and dispositions can find themselves in an abused relationship.
Absolutely. Being a survivor, it's really important that I speak out on behalf of others because, and I talk about the signs and I talk about the fact that there are so many myths surrounding domestic violence or coercive behavior that we have to out and destroy. And one of them is that idea that it's weaker less educated women who are not strong. It can happen to anyone in any relationship, as you say, male or female. And it is spotting those signs. And actually, that was the one chapter in the book my friends, family, publishers, most people didn't want me to put in because they felt it would actually diminish how people saw me. And I was like, doesn't matter. I'm not writing it for them or for any of you. I'm writing it for the one woman who might read it. And it gives her the strength to leave and to know that she can survive.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I think if anything, hearing how you had to start working so young to help pay your school and your way and all the different things that you had to overcome in your life certainly was not the picture that was painted of you in the media.
They used all the tools they know that would sort of, you know, elite hedge fund manager's wife, which I'm not, because my husband's not a hedge fund manager now, hasn't been for God knows how many years. You know, there's really three things that were really interesting. The most abuse I got was the fact that it wasn't my place to speak up. The second one is it couldn't possibly be my money, so I must have lots of rich men behind me. Like it wasn't even my husband's money, it was my money. And the third one, which was I couldn't be smart enough, which tells you an awful lot about what some people think about women in society in, you know, 1920s. Sort of 1920s, yeah. 2020s. Today is extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. I mean, the undercurrents of both sexism and racism on all of that stuff is just, it's, you know, to say it's a dog whistle is like, is like a massive understatement, right? It's so obvious.
I got told by a very senior person at the Daily Mail that the thing was I made it easy for them because I was a pinup girl for hate because of all the things that I am. And I thought, what? That's just the strangest perception.
But that's so fucking irresponsible as well.
Yeah, because I complained to Ipsos, I think about 17 times. And this particular complaint, that response was solicited because I'd complained about them always calling me foreign-born Gina Miller. And I said, but you never write foreign-born Boris Johnson. You're not applying the same level of care to me as other people. And because you're writing this way, it's resulting in me getting death threats. But I lost the case.
Yeah, you shouldn't have. Okay, what don't women talk enough about?
Well, domestic violence, for one.
Mm.
Sex. Mm-hmm. We don't talk enough about that. And just not coping.
Yeah. I think there was another part of your book where you said that you've known a lot of women who have worked really hard and have leaned in. I don't know if you use that phrase, but that's certainly how I interpreted it, into their careers and into their lives. And then they get to the mid-level management in their 30s and they're just tired. And I was like, oh my God, I can so relate to that. Like, I've been leaning in, but now I'm really tired.
Yeah, no, unfortunately, all the statistics show, because I try and keep all my arguments fact-based. Most initiatives, especially in the corporate world, tend to be at entry level. And then you get those who try and do initiatives to increase diversity at board level. But in the middle, you're left on your own. It's really tough when you're in middle management or you're coming up. There's so little support.
Yeah. So there's the things that we can do to change organizations, but what do you think women can do that is within their own power to change that, to just strike a balance, but also achieve the things they want to achieve in life and be the best that they can be?
Most women I know who are incredibly ambitious are also pretty perfectionist and a little OCD. Mm-hmm. Things have got to give somewhere. You're just trying to do everything to A grade, top notch, just doesn't work. So some things you just have to figure out what gives a little and what you won't give. And you have to work that out for yourself, not with any other input, but you being totally honest with yourself. I think that's one thing we can do for ourselves. But I think in the workplace, I think we've got to work with each other to make voices heard and concerns heard. Because a number of women who've said to me, oh, yeah, I really want to say something, but the problem is it will affect my promotion possibilities. You know, people look at me, they'll think I'm a troublemaker. But actually, if you do it in a group, it lessens the possibility of you being silenced.
That harkens back as well to Elizabeth Lesser's book, How Much Power Women Have as Collaborators with One Another. And she talks about going back just centuries, right, in stories that we've told ourselves and how that was always of great fear to the people who were in power, that it was like, you know, you can't trust women who are in collaboration with one another because that's where the real power is.
Yeah, exactly. When it was the anniversary, 100-year anniversary of the suffragettes, the Modern History Museum in London had an exhibition and I was invited to go and see it before it opened. And actually, in some of the cabinets were the front pages from the Daily Mail, who were actually the ones who called them suffragettes, named them that. But also they had all these cartoons of being a bad wife, a bad mother, neglecting your children, all these things, these cartoons. And I was thinking, my God, it's 100 years and they're still doing it.
They're still doing it. God, someone needs to hold them to account. Okay. What's an opinion you once held strongly that you've since changed your mind about?
What success really is. I think growing up, it was a huge emphasis on the fact that it had to do with awards and monetary rewards, as well as accolades in be it promotion or, you know, winning prizes. And it isn't about that. It's about getting up every day and knowing you're going to do the best you can, and going to bed at night with your head light, knowing you did the best you could. That is real success.
What unearned privilege or unfair advantage has been most instrumental to your success so far?
Being in the right place at the right time, just having luck. I've had some amazing times when I've been lucky enough to be in the right room and to be able to put the right deals together, because it's not always just having great ideas or working hard. There is an element of luck there too. And there have been three occasions in my life, in my business life, where I've been lucky. And in my private life, I was so lucky to meet my husband, Alan, my present husband, because without him being so understanding of who I am and what I want to achieve, I wouldn't be able to have my family and my career.
Mm. I have an incredibly supportive husband as well. And I can't imagine, I mean, and I'm, you know, do not have your notoriety, Tina, but still cannot imagine being able to do, I probably don't think I'd be able to do about 60% of what I do and have my son. Or I'd be able to do pretty much everything I do and not have my son. But I can't imagine both without having somebody else's support. I have a lot of respect for single moms, single dads who don't have a lot of family support around them, because it's a challenge for sure.
When you find somebody who actually encourages you to be, and it's an awful phrase, but to be the who you really want to be and the best you can be, it is absolutely priceless.
Mm. What are you still insecure about?
I'm still nervous when I go onto media, and I never know if it's a good or bad thing, but it's not because I'm nervous about how I come across, but I just want to make sure that the time I have then, I'm doing as much as I can in reaching out with the messages I'm trying to reach out with.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how did you feel, for example, after that Andrew Neil interview?
I was pretty shocked, because I said it was early on in when I was starting to do media connected with the case and on that sort of platform, because I mean, I've been a campaigner for 30 years, but never in this sort of profile. And it was the sort of the beginning of this new profile, this bigger profile. And what was extraordinary about that interview is that they do this clip before and they send you out and you do this filming like a storyboard before you go on the program. And they had helped draft it and they changed some of the words and fine. So they put it together and I sat on the sofa and then he ripped apart. He laid into me about something they'd written in the script. Mm. And because I was so naive in those days, I didn't have a team. It was just me and I didn't read the whole thing and think. But he twisted something that they'd written. And I remember coming off the show thinking, my gosh, you can't trust a single person in this business.
I mean, one of the reasons I love podcasting as a format, especially these long interview formats, is because, I can't say that, you know, no interview has an agenda, but it feels so much less driven by an agenda, if you know what I mean.
It was the same thing as well. There was a time when I went on Mars, sort of just before that, and Andrew Neil, where I was on with Nigel Farage. And I had asked before we went on, I said, oh, well, presumably Nigel will be in a different part of the show because I don't want to be in the studio with him. And they said, no problem at all. He's in a different section of the show. He'll be on first talking to Andrew and then he'll come out through a different door and you'll go in. So that was fine. So I agreed it, went in, Nigel Farage was interviewed, left the sofa. I was then came in. And then they said to me, would you mind if Nigel came and we did an interview with you two together? And before I know it, he was walking in. And it was a setup again. And that's the thing I had to learn and to realize is that, you know, I had to have somebody. And I did then have an agency and had someone who used to come with me who was experienced, because my inexperience meant that I was easy to set up. But it was quite an odd thing because I saw Farage coming in. I'd never met him. And I saw him walking in. And the way they have you on the sofa when it's Mar and then the two of you, it's a really tight shot. And so I don't know what made me do this, Cassandra, but I just patted the sofa next to me and said to Nigel, come on, come closer. I don't know what made me say that, but his face, he didn't know where to put himself. And it made him, I straight away saw him become incredibly nervous. And I don't know what it is that made me do that, But I was really terrified. And then some calm came over me as if to say, you can do this. It was just a really weird sort of mix of emotions.
Yeah, I'm so glad you did. That context makes a lot of sense now.
I've learned a few tricks of the trade, but I try to resist. It's the other thing that's really interesting in my journey over the last few years is I started getting approaches from media companies or media trainers or, you know, third parties saying, you know, now you're on this platform, we can offer you a discounted rate to do this and we can train you to do that. And the amount of people who wanted to train me to not sound like me, I kept saying to my husband, what is wrong with being me? I just don't understand all these people who want to train me to sound like, because I kept saying over and over, lots of different people, you could sound like a politician. I kept thinking, that's exactly who I don't want to sound like. But it was really quite interesting that I suddenly got all these approaches from people who thought that I would bite their arms off to be media trained.
That's funny. I love that they wanted to make you sound like a politician. I was thinking they were going to try to. Have you ever seen an interview with Kellyanne Conway? She has this style that I imagine every media trainer wants every woman to sound like. I mean, she will say the most horrible things, but she will do it with the warmest smile.
Yes.
And with very respectful words. And I remember reading an article, I think it was in the New Yorker or in New York magazine, I can't remember which one, but it said something like the dark magic of Kellyanne Conway. Yeah. And that's exactly what it felt like. Again, I can imagine that's what a lot of media trainers want women to do, is be very friendly, very respectful, smile, smile, smile.
Oh, yes. I was told I had to smile more, keep my lips slightly apart, make sure I always went on with curly hair, you know, done, mustn't have it straight, never have it tied up, never wear it studying. I mean, there's all these things. And I was just thinking the amount of time I'd have to put into thinking about those things, I'd forget what it was I was going to say. I mean, it's just, but the other thing I did learn, which was interesting on the politician's point of view, is that even when they'd come in with their sort of teams of people, I remember this with sort of Dominic Raab, and they'd have all these sheets, and it was actually question time, and they'd have all these script sheets and everything. And I was sitting next to him, and I don't know if he wears glasses or not, but for whatever reason, the font size was really huge. All I did was sat there, and when he was on a particular topic, I knew what he was going to say because it was on the sheet of paper. So I just look at what he was going to go, what he'd been handed and was going to go and say. And then I just preempted. And what I realized is that they're not particularly prepared, or they just have a particular line they're going to say anyway. So it doesn't matter what the question is, they've already got these things pre-prepared. And it gives me an opportunity to actually come in and say, have you thought about this? And throw facts at them. So I learned along the way that actually, if I was prepared, that was all the confidence I needed. But it still means that I get nervous.
Yeah, I'm sure. When do you feel you're most powerful?
When I'm hugging my children. Because I'm their mother. What they become, I have an influence on that. That's power.
Yeah. Last question. What are you really fucking good at?
Oh, I'm brilliant at Latin dancing.
Really? Do you get to, again, one of the things I read in your book was that you don't go out that much now that you have so much notoriety. But is that changed now? I mean,
when we go abroad and stuff, and when we're out of the UK and stuff. No. When I'm in Ibiza or wherever, I love to dance. You'll never get me off the dance floor.
Oh my, okay. Now that you've dropped Ibiza and dancing, there's a whole other interview to do here. Gina, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for spending so much time with me today. There are so many things I actually didn't get to ask you about that I had planned, particularly about Messages of Love, which I know is your most recent venture. Did you want to tell us a little bit about that before we sign off?
We've got such antiquated laws when it comes to will making and not using technology. And what I wanted to do was two things. One is to try and start a campaign so we'd have use of technology by bedsides and allow people when it's making wills to use video conferencing, etc. And we've actually got temporary legislation that's gone through Parliament, voted through. So we're really pleased about that. When I was receiving death threats and under house arrest almost and being looked after by the terrorist squad, every day I think about my children not having me there with them. So I started writing letters to them individually. And every day I'd write more and more and leave them photographs and all sorts of things. And I thought, if only people could do that, but in a digital box, so it's safe. And if they could delete it in future, if they recovered. And so I started a digital platform for leaving memory boxes called Messages of Love. And we've had lots of people use it in the lockdowns. But I have to say, people are now already coming to me, are already saying to us, will I be able to delete it in summer when we're out of COVID? And I've said, you could delete it, you take ownership, whatever. But I just wanted it to be a free place where people could come and just give themselves a little bit of comfort that they were leaving messages of love to those that might be left behind when they were gone.
That's so beautiful. That's so beautiful. So if people want to learn more about what you're up to now, whether it's messages of love or more about the book, where should they go?
I think now this year, 2021, for me, my three big things. One is there is absolutely nothing in the Brexit deal for financial services. I'm really worried about what happens to our capital markets and the city. And so, you know, campaigning to try and make us sort of reform in a way that sets us as a gold standard for consumer protection in the city. I'm going to, you know, we have an opportunity, so I'm going to go for it. Second one is on the online harms bill and trying to bring regulation and duties of care to social media platforms and working around the globe with a few different parties to try, because it is something that needs to happen on an international basis. But again, that's going really well. And the third one is still in working with domestic violence charities, trying to bring in programs now to help young women who, unbelievably, there has been a massive increase in young women, especially universities age and above, suffering from coercive behavior. There's something very strange that's happened in the last sort of 20 months. And so trying to educate women to see the signs early so they get out of these dangerous coercive relationships.
So that trend actually predates COVID. So it's not like...
Yeah, we were seeing it. Funny enough, it's increased after the Brexit vote. There is a correlation there. The misogynistic behavior increased, but so did coercive behavior.
You know, this is an absolute hypothesis based on no fact whatsoever, but I do wonder if it's somehow linked to the increasing rise of these, you know, groups on social media for disaffected men. There's all sorts of stuff on, like, you know, how to train your women. And we've seen a rise in that.
Yeah, it's kind of part of a mindset that's much more far right, which is that women should know their place.
Yeah. Okay. So where should people go if they want to learn more about those initiatives and about you?
Well, I suppose trueandfaircampaign.com is where I'm doing my work for reforming the city and trying to bring some better practices rather than the ripoffs and dubious behaviors that happen in the financial world. And the rest of it, just watch this space, because I pop up from time to time doing all sorts of things.
Thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute joy getting to know you a little bit.
Great. Great fun. Thank you.
If you've enjoyed the series so far, please do subscribe, rate, and leave a review wherever you're listening right now. It really does help us reach incredible women to introduce you to on the show. While you're at it, check out the show notes for more info on our guests and to find out how to reach us on all the socials. Thanks for listening, and I'll meet you here again next week.